Morning, you may be seated. The first case, in our calendar is 06-1166, Frank Gliozzo versus University Urologist of Cleveland, Mr. Galvin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may I please the court. My name is Martin Galvin. I'm representing the appellants. Your Honors, this is a case which is relatively straightforward on the facts. Very few of the facts are in dispute. Initially, the appellee timely filed his lawsuit after having sent a 180-day letter. In sending this 180-day letter, which is used in medical malpractice cases, as the court is aware, the appellee was very thorough in ensuring receipt of the letter. The appellee made sure that these 180-day letters were hand-delivered and that they were signed for, and that's contained in the record. Yet after the lawsuit was filed, the appellee was far less thorough in ensuring completion of service. It is not disputed that service was attempted only one time on each of the appellants. It is further not disputed that the fact of failure of service on each appellant was clearly and unambiguously entered on the docket of the trial court. Furthermore, it is not disputed that appellants timely answered and appropriately, according to the dictates of Civil Rule 12D, raised the affirmative defenses of lack of service, failure of service, and lack of jurisdiction.
What was the date of the initial service attempt?
It was in January of 2004. I don't know the exact date.
When did the statute of limitations run?
The statute of limitations would have run on November 28th, 2003, which would have been pursuant to the 180-day letter.
So the 180-day letter had how many days left on it after January?
It expired before January. The lawsuit was actually filed on November 14th, 2003.
I guess one of the questions I have is, I understand that in some of these cases, the defendant won't alert them to failure of service or won't do anything to try to, you know, help the plaintiff perfect service on them to get them past the statute. That doesn't seem to be the case here. The statute had actually already run, and it was just a matter of service being perfected, correct?
Correct. The statute had run, and then, of course, under Civil Rule 3A, they had 1 year to complete service.
Okay, then that brings me to my second question. If there's no advantage to the defendant in delaying alerting the other side to their failure other than preserving it as an issue, why would a defendant, in particularly a case like this, go through all this expert witness and effort and depositions before raising it as a motion to dismiss? I don't understand why there's this. Why would you wait?
But Justice Strand, the reason that a defendant would wait and the reason defendant waited in this case is because they have that 1 year under Civil Rule 3A. So once the case is timely filed, they have 1 year to complete service. And our answer is filed 9 months prior to that.
So you are trying to run the clock out on the 1 year before you file your motion so as not to basically help the other side service.
We're trying to preserve all available defenses.
Okay. I couldn't understand that delay. Now
Is the issue now before our court, Mr. Galvin, one of waiver?
It is one of waiver because
it's not jurisdiction.
Well, it is both jurisdiction and waiver. The Court of Appeals found that there was waiver. We don't know exactly what the Court of Appeals determined was waiver. The Court of Appeals said that this case was vigorously defended.
Well, wasn't the idea that because the defense had participated in all of the discovery, though an affirmative defense was raised in the responsive pleading, the participation for the better part of a year waived any claim because all parties had been properly given notice and participated in the suit?
That's exactly what the Court of Appeals determined. The Court of Appeals determined that not only participation in discovery, but they listed seven things.
Why shouldn't one's participation constitute a waiver of service?
Because
that party, the purpose of service is to make sure that the party is aware, has notice of the claim so that there'd be an opportunity to provide a defense. And when that party is then in court, providing the defense with full notice of the nature of the claim, why shouldn't there be a waiver?
Well, Justice O'Donnell, if all that was required was notice of the pendency of an action, then we'd have no need for the civil rules governing service. We'd have no need for the civil rules governing when and how an action is commenced, and we'd have no need for civil rules governing affirmative defenses, how they're pled, and when they're properly raised. If, and this was discussed in the case of Bell versus Midwestern Educational Services, if mere notice is all that's required, why do we even have an affirmative defense? Why can we even assert in an answer pursuant to Rule 12D that the defendant has the affirmative defense of lack of service of process or that the court lacks jurisdiction? The rules could be changed, but the rules as they presently exist and all the case law that is out there say otherwise, and they say that notice is not enough and that notice is not necessarily even relevant.
And I believe your point in your brief and the questions I asked about the statute of limitations is if you filed an early motion to dismiss before engaging in discovery, they could easily cure the service and you've essentially hurt your client by helping the service get completed. Is that the point that they try to make?
Correct, Justice Strachan.
It sounds like games playing. You're playing the time out as long as you can to get past the one-year service date so that they're stuck. They can't serve you now officially.
Correct. And the issue of gamesmanship has also been discussed extensively in the case law that's out there, both from this court in First Marietta Bank versus Klein and again in Bell versus Midwestern Educational Service.
Well, counsel, did you answer, though, to distract the plaintiff from the fact that they hadn't perfected service?
No, we answered and we raised the available affirmative defenses, which included lack of jurisdiction and failure of service of process. That's what Civil Rule 12D says you need to do. Now, prior to the civil rules, you had special appearances and you had general appearances. You could enter a special appearance just for the purpose of contesting jurisdiction. We did away with that distinction with the civil rules. The civil rules now say there's only general appearances. And if you make a general appearance, the way you preserve that defense under Civil Rule 12D is by asserting it as an affirmative defense.
Okay.
Which is what was done here. And on Justice Stratton's question on gamesmanship, what the Bell Court said is whether the lawsuit is a game or a serious search for truth and the fixation of blame, it is and must be played by certain rules, and we cannot disregard these rules to assist a party who has failed to abide by them. The majority decision below actually chronicled seven things that the defendant did, or the appellant did, or appellants, which they decided or concluded constituted a waiver of service. These seven things are filing an answer, attending a case management conference, engaging in discovery, exchanging expert reports, attending a pretrial, filing a motion for summary judgment, and finally filing a motion in limine. There are two principal problems with the rationale of the majority decision. The first principal problem is that it gives absolutely no guidance as to when this waiver occurred. The court merely said, you did all these things, and we're going to look at the big picture and say that amounts to waiver. Yet there's no guidance was it attending a CMC? Was it appearing at a deposition? Was it preparing for trial and filing the motions in limine? That there's no guidance from the majority decision below on to when this waiver happened. The majority decision also did not, and I think this is an important point, accept the appellee's argument that mere notice is sufficient. And once there's notice of the pendency of an action, we need not look at the archaic procedural service rules. The court didn't say that. What the court said was the length of the defense and the relative vigor of the defense were the two principal factors which resulted in waiver.
Mr. Galvin, how important was it that you pled the lack of service initially? Would the situation regarding waiver be different had you not pled the lack of service and then continued on and then raised it for the first time later on?
The answer to your question, Justice Lanzinger, is that it was critically important. If that had not been raised in the initial pleading, it would have been waived. That's what all the case law says. In addition to being confusing and impractical and not offering any guidance, the majority decision below is also suffers from the more basic problem in that it's fundamentally wrong. We look to Civil Rule 3A. The majority decision is inconsistent with that, with Civil Rule 4D, with Civil Rule 4E, with Civil Rule 12D, with Civil Rule 12H3, Revised Code 2305.17, and case law both from this court and from around the state. Also, initially, it is clear that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in making such an important and paramount issue of the timing of the motion to dismiss. As this court is aware, the majority decision stressed it at least two different points in its opinion that this motion to dismiss was not filed until the eve of trial, which is really 10 days before trial. Yet Civil Rule 12D states that a motion raising a defense enumerated in Civil Rule 12B 1 through 7, any of those defenses, quote, shall be heard and determined before trial on the application of any party. And we also know from First Bank of Marietta versus Klein that you don't even have to do it before trial. If you want to wait till after trial, or at least until after the completion of all evidence at trial, you have the right to do so. The appellants in this case made such an application 10 days before trial. Thus, the trial court timely heard this motion and properly decided it on its merits. Likewise, Civil Rule 12H3 states that whenever it appears by suggestion of the parties or otherwise that the court lacks jurisdiction, whenever it appears jurisdiction of the subject matter, the court shall dismiss the action. Again, that goes back to the critical issue of timing. Civil Rule 12H3 says it can be done whenever it appears the court lacked jurisdiction. At the time the motion to dismiss was granted and considered in this case, it was April of 2005. The 1 year had long since passed for perfecting service. The court patently, plainly, and unambiguously lacked jurisdiction, and the trial court did the right thing in granting the motion to dismiss. The appellee concedes that the litany of cases cited by the appellants and cited by the dissenting opinion below are not reconcilable with the majority opinion below. Yet for some reason, the appellee insists that First Bank of Marietta, this court's opinion is not applicable to the facts of this case. I respectfully submit that that could not be any less true.
They argue that the court in Klein did not refer to waiver, that waiver didn't seem to be raised. I thought it was raised, but what's your response to that?
The issue was waived. The way the court framed the issue in Klein was to say that they looked at Civil Rule 12D and said, is it mandatory that an application be made before trial? Because as this court is aware, the application was not made until the close of evidence. And the court concluded that it is not mandatory, that it can be made before trial, and if it's made before trial, the motion shall be heard. But you can actually wait until the completion of evidence if you choose to do so. In this case, the motion was made 10 days before trial. So under the rationale of Klein, there's no way to say that this was delayed, that there's an issue of latches or of waiver. I see I have less than 2 minutes left. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. Papa.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Nick Papa, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Frank Liazzo. I think there's a couple of additional facts as far as a time frame here that it's important for the court to be aware of. The complaint was filed on November 14, 2003. The service of process deadline, the 1 year look back requirement to get service, expired on November 15, 2004, because there was a weekend, so it went to the next preceding business day, which was a Monday. The dispositive motion deadline was January 28, 2005. There were 74 days in between when the service of process should have been perfected as of November 15th of 04, and when the dispositive motion deadline came, which was January 28th, 2005. In those 74 days, A motion to dismiss based on the lack of service of process was not made. Additionally, appellants waited until April 4th, 2005 to file their motion to dismiss. This is 66 days after the dispositive motion deadline, 150 days after the service of process deadline, or almost 5 months, and only 9 days before trial.
If you follow Klein, that wouldn't seem to matter, would it?
If you follow Klein, that would not seem to matter. However, I don't believe the court in Klein addressed the specific issue that's presently before this court. And that is, as phrased by our proposition of law, whether an action is commenced for the purpose of applying the statute of limitations on the date service is attained when a party submits to the court's jurisdiction such that the defendant waives the affirmative defenses of insufficiency of service of process when he files untimely motion to dismiss. Remember, we have a dispositive motion cutoff.
In Klein, they did not file an answer raising the defense, did they?
I do not believe they did, Your Honor.
I asked sort of the flip question of opposing counsel about why they waited, and I think I understand now with the 1 year period. Why, if you have an answer that asserts insufficient process, would you not go back and cure it?
That's a great question. And to be quite frank and honest with the court, in the realities of litigation, there's boilerplate affirmative defenses asserted in all negligence actions. I know we have a Rule 11 requirement of a good faith basis, but just before we came here, I pulled 10 cases of answers that were filed, the last 10 cases that we filed as plaintiffs, and there were 5 boilerplate affirmative defenses you see in every case, and those were failure to state a claim, statute of limitations, insufficiency of service of process, comparative negligence, and failure to join parties. In my 15 years of practice, I've seen those defenses in all the answers, and I've never once had a motion to dismiss for the failure to join parties.
But that still doesn't really excuse the duty of a counsel to double check a very, very crucial issue.
That is correct. However, there was an interrogatory directed to, talking about gamesmanship, mm-hmm. There was an interrogatory directed to the defendant and asked them, if you are asserting an affirmative defense, please state the factual basis for that defense. That answer was not given. Instead, an objection was raised. Now, taking consideration this, Your Honor, is...
But you didn't follow up with the judge.
We did not follow up with this, but take this in consideration. Once again, going back to the realities of litigation, is that the service of process wasn't defective from the standpoint, oh, you're supposed to do something different, maybe not certified mail, maybe publication. The process itself wasn't defective. What the defendants have claimed is that they never received a copy of the complaint at all. They've never received the interrogatories. So then somehow an answer is filed. The notice that was sent out regarding this failure of service was sent out on January 12th.
But if they heard through the grapevine this had been filed and they went and pulled it from the court, you aren't alleging that constitutes service, are you?
No, I'm not at all alleging constitutes service, but I'm trying to answer your question of why didn't trial counsel look at the docket? Because, first of all, trial counsel has stated since day one he's never received notice, did not receive the notice from the court, okay?
Of failure of service.
Failure of service. And then, in reality, you have plaintiff's counsel calling up for the extension of time to file an answer, filing of an answer, so forth and so on, would lead one to believe that indeed service was actually perfected.
Is one of your strongest arguments then that if in fact this defense was raised, that the fact that there was a dispositive motion cutoff should have controlled in terms of their ability to raise it in a motion to dismiss?
That is correct. And that's because the statute of limitations ran out to get service on November 15th of 04. So they had plenty of time between November 15th to January 28th to file that motion.
Isn't that just left to the discretion of the trial court to entertain the dispositive motion after the cutoff date that it imposed?
Yes, it is left to discretion of the trial court. Matter of fact, the first motion that was filed was actually denied for being untimely.
So your best argument is that the court abused its discretion in entertaining this motion?
That's one of the arguments, Your Honor. But if we're trying to set forth a time frame of I believe the question was posed to opposing counsel, when should they have filed this motion? And when should we have a cutoff for rule of law? I believe it should be sometime, if you have a dispositive motion cutoff, it should be either that time or shortly thereafter. Not let's wait, because let's look at what happened after the dispositive motion deadline, okay? You had several depositions taking place. You had the plaintiff's, the defendant doctor's, defendant expert doctor taking place at Mr. Gliauzo's expense. You had plaintiff's expert deposition taking place.
I understand they all participated in the litigation. That really isn't contested.
Right.
But what you're asking us to do is to look at this situation and fashion some rule of law that's going to apply.
That is correct.
And in reality, that's already been done in the civil rules. All of the defenses that you articulated very well are contained in the rule. And any defendant in any case has the ability to assert any or all of those in every pleading, which was done. And the rule says that these should be brought for hearing before trial, and that was done. So, in effect, haven't the civil rules already set up the guidelines for procedure throughout the state of Ohio? And why should we distinguish this case from what we've told every lawyer in our state they should be doing in prosecuting their cases? And we followed that for a long time. And as the Chief points out, I agree with you, Marietta isn't really on all fours, but I do think it's some precedent that we can look to.
I think you have to look at the requirements and the primary goal of what's set forth in Civil Rule 1B to effectuate just results by eliminating delay, unnecessary expense, and all other impediments to the expeditious administration of justice. And if you take that in consideration with judicial economy, you have to ask yourself, because you have to remember, after the dispositive motion deadline, there was a good $20,000 to $30,000 worth of work as far as experts and depositions taken by the plaintiff. I know defense counsel had to match that.
Well, let me ask you the question the other way. If the rules already set up the guidelines for when defenses and what defenses can be asserted and when they should be heard, what rule do you want us to write in this case that would change what's already been established?
I think the rule of law would be that if you participate in litigation and you continue to go forward with litigation, and then you wait until well after, we're talking well after the dispositive motion deadline, to bring a motion to dismiss for lack of service of process, I believe that your actions constitutes a waiver. If you look at...
So we would have to modify the rule that says that that has to be heard. We'd have to change the civil rules.
I don't know if you would have to change the civil rules or pronouncement by this court like they did in Mississippi State Hospital versus Adams. Similar situation, almost identical, where you had every court of appeal stating that, hey, you cannot have a waiver. And every court of appeals in Mississippi stated you cannot have a waiver. Even if you litigate and went to trial, you can't have a waiver. And then the Mississippi Supreme Court stated, you know, although the defendants may have literally complied with the civil rules by raising its affirmative defenses in its answers, the defendant did not comply with the spirit of the civil rules because the defendants fully participated in the litigation case for more than 2 years without actively contesting jurisdiction in any way. Sure, we have a boilerplate language that you see in all answers, failure of service of process or failure due to statute of limitations. But there was no active participation contesting jurisdiction other than right before trial.
Counsel, in your rule of law that you articulated, you use the phrase that well after the dispositive motion cutoff date. Okay.
Right.
Now, that would suggest to me that well after would be a discretionary call by the trial court.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
And isn't that what we had here, a discretionary call by the trial court? And you're asking us to state that abuse of the trial courts?
I don't think we have a discretionary call by the trial court, because the trial court uses discretion to entertain the motion, and they made a determination that based on the Court of Appeals cases, the trial court had no choice but to dismiss it. They did not go the extra step to make a determination whether there was waiver, because they never addressed that issue in the trial court.
If there were no dispositive motion cutoff date in this case, would you lose?
I would say I would have a hard case to win, Your Honor, to be honest with you.
So your case is dependent upon the ruling on the court with respect to allowing or entertaining the motion beyond the dispositive motion cutoff date.
Correct. And I think you should also look at the 2000 Ohio Courts Future Commission's report conclusion that stated one of the most significant concerns expressed by the public was that litigation takes too long and costs too much. And isn't that what we're doing here? Is where we're have a dispositive motion cutoff. It could have been brought earlier, but instead, the motion was brought 9 days before trial, and all this work was done, and all this expense was done. If the motion was brought, let's say, on November 15th, it would preserve the appellant's right to wait to file the motion and still have the same results. Once again, and the issue comes back of why wasn't answer filed? And that was always hit me as part of, if the defendant was never served, why was an answer filed? If an answer wasn't, there is absolutely no obligation upon the defendant to file an answer if they never were served.
Yeah, but they could then end up with a default judgment and then have to try to undo the default judgment, and that's a pretty heavy burden.
Well, actually, with all due respect, no, they would not have a default judgment.
Well, there's
because they never were served with the answer, because it came back as being unclaimed. So therefore, when plaintiff's counsel, trial counsel, would have went to file a default judgment and would have checked to make sure service was obtained,
A lot of courts don't check those service records. You file your default, allege you have service. They rarely will check them, and they'll grant it to you, and it's up the other side to undo it. That's the reality of the practice.
Isn't what happened, it seems to me, is that the defendant did what Klein says the defendant could do, and they hoped that the plaintiff's counsel would see it as a boilerplate, and the defense counsel then waits till just before trial, files a motion to dismiss, and under Klein, the trial court dismisses. It is gamesmanship, and perhaps we should change the rule to prevent that. As you say, there's been a lot of clients' money expended in this case for naught. But the rule and the rule of law, it seems to me at this point, is Klein.
Your Honor, I would once again respectfully disagree with that assessment, because I don't know if Klein actually addressed the precise issue before this court. I did not see in there where they addressed whether there was an actual waiver based on the facts as we know them in this case. And I think this court could draft a rule of law and specifically apply it to the case in hand. And I'll follow up with a conclusion. I see that my time has almost ended. As demonstrated, the appellate court was correct in finding that the appellant waived its affirmative defense of statute of limitations. As such, we request you uphold the Court of Appeals ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Papa. Mr. Galvin, you saved a little more than a minute and a half of your time.
Mr. Galvin, why wasn't the motion filed before the dispositive cutoff date?
Well, the dispositive motion issue is a bit of a red herring, because there was a dispositive motion filed. The defendants at trial didn't just ignore the dispositive motion deadline. They filed a motion for summary judgment based on the facts. That motion for summary judgment led to the plaintiffs dismissing three of their four counts, voluntarily dismissing. Only one count was to proceed to trial. But there was no necessity to raise the jurisdiction issue and the court's lack of jurisdiction at the time of the dispositive motion cutoff. I mean, Civil Rule 12D tells us that, Klein tells us that, Civil Rule 12H3 says that, and Civil Rule 50, which governs directed verdicts, tells us the same thing.
But counsel suggests that the time ran November, I think he said, 15th of 2004. And would you agree that you had the right to file a motion to dismiss for lack of service at that point? The motion cutoff date then was January 28th of 2005, and if I understand it correctly, the motion was not filed until April. So from November till April, we had all this litigation going on without the issue being raised by your client.
I would agree that some point after November 15th of 2004, this issue could have been raised, but we also have the right to raise this issue at any time prior to the completion of evidence. And that's what Klein says, and that's exactly what
we did. Wouldn't a natural concern for us trying to make our rules function efficiently and to achieve getting resolution in a case as early and as inexpensively as possible for the clients, would it be unreasonable for us to look at this and say the lawyers for the defendant wanted to keep the billing clock running for a while longer?
I think
is that unreasonable to look at this fact scenario and conclude that?
Justice Pfeiffer, I would respectfully suggest that it would be unreasonable. I don't think it's true. And if you look at Klein and these other cases that go all the way through trial, this was filed 10 days before trial. The motion to dismiss was not as delayed, if you want to use that term, as many other cases where this has been decided. And it's what the civil rules permit.
When was the motion for summary judgment filed?
It was filed in January of 2005.
So that's after the clock has run on service, right?
It is after the clock has run on service.
When was it ruled on?
I believe, I don't know the exact date, it was March of 2004. The trial court actually said that they don't even have an expert. They only have one claim, which is informed consent, but you know, they said there was an issue because of the defendant's deposition, Dr. Resnick. And I think when we're looking to the responsibility here, we just look to Civil Rule 4.6E. That's another existing civil rule, and it clearly says who has responsibility for ensuring that service has been perfected and it's plaintiff's counsel. And I see that my time is up. I would urge that this court reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals as bad law and bad public policy.
Thank you, Mr. Galvin. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.